It's a pleasure to welcome you back and to introduce my colleague, Katrina Jameson. You probably know Katrina came here a number of years ago and is really the quintessential translational researcher, scientist, physician. She's not only uncovered pathways, molecular pathways involving cancer, but she's also helped to develop and literally test the drugs that target those pathways here. And she'll be doing a bit of a tag team effort. And we'd like to welcome Katrina Jameson.
Thank you very much, David. I'd like to begin by really thanking the pioneers who have allowed us to do this translational research. We heard a lot this morning about bench to bedside and back again. And I just wanted to say the reason we can do that here is we have a particularly prescient population of patients that have the good fortune to be able to work with us, but more often vice versa. We are so grateful for our patients, and we really partner with them in understanding how to move forward with some very tough diseases that they happen to have, but have taken a real leadership role in directing us forward in clinical trials. So I'd like to thank my patient, Linda Lowe, who's here, if you want to take a stand, with her family, her granddaughter, who are trying to get interested in science at a very early age. And I think she's going to get back to work in the lab now. All right, so I wanted to talk about the reason that we've embarked on some rather new clinical trials, and that's because Irv and I got started on this a few years ago. Actually, it was more than a decade ago, working together on leukemia stem cells and trying to understand the molecular triggers of these cells, how they're initiated and how they're propagated in various hematologic malignancies that happen to be refractory to most standard therapies. Now, John Dick first described leukemia stem cells in 1994 and suggested that they were a subpopulation of cells within the marrow that had the capacity to propagate disease, unlike the original stochastic model, which suggested that every cell in the bone marrow of a patient with leukemia could propagate disease. So this was a phenotypically distinct population, and a lot of work has been done to identify the leukemia stem cell molecular properties that allow them to self-renew and become dormant and protective niches, thereby allowing them to evade standard therapies. Now, what Irv and I suggested in 2004 was that there was a process of malignant reprogramming that occurred in more committed progenitors, where the progenitors, rather than the stem cells, thought they were stem cells. They'd co-opted stem cell properties, such as the capacity to regenerate or self-renew, to have enhanced survival, become dormant in supportive niches, and then differentiate. Now, that was something that was met with some skepticism at the time and has taken a few years to unravel, and certainly something that we can do now more easily with a partnership with our patients who have really helped us in terms of unraveling what happens in human disease. Now, we focused on myeloproliferative neoplasms, which are disorders where you make too many of one kind of cell in the bone marrow, because we can see sequentially how these diseases progress. So it allows us to look at what are the initiating events that get the disease going, and what are the events that really allow the disease to undergo what's called blastic transformation, which is the progression to acute leukemia. These disorders were first described in 1951 by William Damschek, who made the prescient observation that the cells seem to be proliferating clonally as if responding to a myelostimulatory agent, and they tended to go to these extramedullary sites, meaning bone marrow formation outside of the bone marrow. And you can see it can be in really quite painful places. This is a patient of mine who had extramedullary hematopoiesis in her knee. These disorders can be quite insidious, as in the case of polycythemia vera, where they make too many red cells. This is a patient's hand compared to his wife's. He didn't know why. He was confused. His hemoglobin was 23, with normal being 14. So these disorders are commonly involving a multipotent progenitor. They lead to marrow hypercellularity and a propensity to clot and bleed 36-fold more than the general population, which is a huge problem. The potential for evolution to acute leukemia varies amongst these disorders, and that's really what we're trying to understand. Now, we just moved part of the lab over to the Sanford Consortium for Regenerative Medicine, and it makes me think that just about anything's possible, because people keep jumping off this cliff in front of us, and most of them come back. So, But this is what happens, I think, with progenitors in these myeloproliferative neoplasms. They go the wrong way in terms of differentiation. I think they can be redirected, but they're going to need some coaxing to do that. So when you look at normal hematopoiesis, as Irv has so eloquently described it, really it's only the long-term hematopoietic stem cell that has robust regenerative capacity. And as these cells decide to differentiate along the myeloid lineage, they should lose that capacity. Unfortunately, in myeloproliferative neoplasms, as they progress, they start to co-opt the stem cell property of self-renewal and reactivate it. So that's why we really focused on seeing if we can understand that process and inhibit it. Now, Irv and I showed in 2006 that if you look at polycythemia vera as a prototypic myeloproliferative neoplasm where you make too many red cells in the marrow, what you have is a mutation at the level of the hematopoietic stem cell, and that's at nucleotide 1849 in this gene called JAK2, which when first described in 1989 by Andrew Wilkes was called just another kinase. He'd spent 5 years trying to clone it, thought his career was over, and then later it was found that it was one of the most important arbiters of what a stem cell is going to become, and really directs myeloid lineage differentiation, and was highly upregulated as a result of this mutation in 97.5% of patients that had this mutation. Now, this was first suggested in 1976 by John Adamson, who's a member of our faculty here. We just showed it by direct sequencing and showed that that mutation was transmitted clonally through to the common myeloid progenitor, granulocyte macrophage progenitor, and megakaryocyte erythroid progenitor progeny of the stem cell. So we wondered, what do you do about this? This is, affects about 100,000 people in this country and can really evolve to a disorder called myelofibrosis, which is scarring of the bone marrow. Gary Gilliland had suggested that that was reversible in a project that we did at the same time, and he showed that using this drug you could reverse that scarring in the bone marrow that was induced by the JAK2 mutation. So this drug was made by a company called Targagen, and as I mentioned earlier, David Cherish was a co-founder of this company. Ida DeChaite insisted that we go over there. There were only two people in my lab at that time. She said, free wine, free food, we were there. So we've got Jolene Shore, who helped to shepherd the original clinical trials and the preclinical development of this drug. And basically, this drug inhibits both JAK2 and FLT3 really quite selectively. And basically, we did a number of studies to show this, but really what happened here, again, the patients helped us. They gave their blood and bone marrow, and we were able to lentivirally transduce the progenitors from that blood, transplant them into highly immunocompromised mice, and see after two-week treatment with this oral JAK2 FLT3 inhibitor that we reduced engraftment, we could reduce engraftment of those red cells, as seen here, and perhaps most importantly, decrease the JAK2 mutant allele burden. So this, together with Gary Gilliland's work and Ayelu Teferi's work, was enough to get us going ahead into a clinical trial that involved 59 patients. This was a phase 1 study run at 6 centers. We were one of the centers here. And what we saw was very similar to what we'd seen in the preclinical study based on patient progenitors. This decrease in the mutant allele burden for patients that had the JAK2 mutation and quite a profound reduction in the leukocytosis that's typical of more advanced disease. Now, this is a patient of mine, the one I showed you with the big knee. She was about to transform to acute leukemia, had 4% circulating blasts and a white count of over 80,000, normal is 11,000. She had a dramatic drop in her leukocytosis, and this is her over a 4-year period. She's working full-time and was the one that was on CBS Evening News in March a couple of years ago. This is what happened with her hemoglobin. You can see it took a little while to come up. What we found was she was stopping at McDonald's before each clinic visit and actually got H. pylori. So once we treated that, her hemoglobin started to come up. So beware of common things. It took a little bit longer for the platelet count to come up. And this is to say that for diseases that have taken a while to develop, it takes a while to reverse them. So the while started at 12 months, which is when we started to see the decrease in her fibrosis. You see this train track sort of scarring here, and the resolution of that at 12 months, and that has persisted now for 4.5 years. Here's somebody else. It was a bit of a surprise, another patient of mine, JAK2 mutation negative, who actually responded, initially was hypocellular, and now has a 30% cellularity with very little fibrosis. So sometimes, we can think we know everything, but really the proof is in the clinical trial. And what we saw there was even patients that don't have mutational activation of the pathway, as Raza was alluding to, can have other reasons for activating the pathway that may initially elude us, but I think it's important to continue to work with our patients to uncover those things. Now, how do these diseases progress? Generally, they acquire a self-renewal pathway mutation. And the best way to study self-renewal is in a disorder that progresses inexorably to blast crisis in the absence of adequate treatment. And that's chronic myeloid leukemia. This is still a myeloproliferative neoplasm. It's just the most malignant one. Now, several years ago, Janet Rowley and others suggested that the chromosome 922 translocation that led to BCR-ABL could actually initiate disease. David Baltimore, Rick Van Etten, and George Daly showed that that was indeed the case. And then what we showed was that you get myeloid progenitor expansion as a result of that BCR-ABL initiating event. So although the BCR-ABL mutation occurs at the level of the hematopoietic stem cell, it actually leads to this myeloid lineage expansion, and then these expanded progenitors are basically unstable and able to acquire other mutations. Now, CML is the hallmark for molecular therapy because it was the first disease to be targeted with an inhibitor called Gleevec that inhibits the constitutive tyrosine kinase activity of BCR-ABL. So we all got to be rather relaxed about what happens with CML. Unfortunately, what we're finding is the prevalence of this disease is growing, but the compliance with therapy doesn't match. So people are forgetting to take their medication, in part because they're near to the fact that they have a potentially fatal disease. We say, you've got leukemia, but you take a pill. It's going to be okay. These medications are very expensive. So I have a patient who had to pay $4,500 for a three-month prescription for Gleevec because he was in the donut hole for Medicare. So what we're finding is people are decreasing the doses of the drug so their prescription lasts longer, which begets resistance. So that's a huge problem. So there may be as many as 200,000 people by the year 2050 with this disease. That means we need to understand what causes resistance and progression. So what we did was we made a lentiviral BCR-ABL vector. This is a human BCR-ABL. And what we did was we transduced CD34-positive cells that had been differentiated from very primitive stem cells and then transplanted them into immunocompromised recipients. And what we found here is that we could get BCR-ABL-positive engraftment in the primary recipients, but actually not in the secondary recipient, suggesting that BCR-ABL does not enhance the regenerative capacity of a stem cell. It just skews its differentiation toward the myeloid lineage. In fact, to enhance regenerative capacity, we have to add a self-renewal agonist like beta-catenin, and even that's not enough to get full-blown blast crisis. So there's something else going on. And that's why we turned to whole transcriptome sequencing. This is in collaboration with Kelly Frazier and Mark O'Mara. And this is through our CIRM disease team grant. We basically had to get the RNA sequencing working to 50 nanograms, and that was something we were able to do with patient samples. We used the Illumina HiSeq and basically identified a splice isoform signature of blastic transformation where we could distinguish chronic phase from blast crisis based on differences in splicing, as Dr. Raza had alluded to. This is a huge theme, not just in myeloproliferative neoplasms, but also in myelodysplastic syndromes, where we're seeing an increased propensity for aberrant splicing. Now, we wondered why was that. A few years ago, we found a mispliced isoform of GSK3-beta, and Irv and I published that in PNAS, and that seemed to be really unique to these leukemic progenitors who were saying, why is there all this abnormal splicing going on? Of course, there are mutations in the spliceosome genes, but are there other potential regulators of splicing? And what we found in looking at the chronic phase to blast crisis transition was an upregulation of RNA editing enzymes. And so what we're seeing is increased A to I editing, and that's something that usually our bodies use to fight viral infections, particularly double-stranded RNA viruses. And what we're seeing is that the interferon-responsive component of this RNA editing gene called ADAR really goes up as BCR-ABL expression is amplified. We're finding from chronic phase to blast crisis, we increase A to I editing. And if we just look at the ADAR target genes, we have this group of genes that completely distinguish normal from blast crisis from chronic phase samples. So that means that you know, as Dr. Raza was alluding to, even if there isn't a viral etiology to these leukemias, the body thinks there is. And it's upregulating these antiviral response genes to try and edit the genome. Unfortunately, it doesn't edit very well, and it doesn't edit at the level of DNA, it's editing at the level of RNA. And this leads to aberrant splice isoforms. Fortunately, we can target some of these isoforms, and we go back to the inhibitor I just talked about, the one that inhibits JAK2 and FLT3. So when we looked at a couple of the isoforms that were upregulated during progression from chronic phase to blast crisis, IL-3 receptor alpha, which signals through JAK2, and FLT3 itself, we said, hey, we've got something for this, and started to work again through the disease team grant to see if we could inhibit the JAK-STAT signaling pathway in blast crisis leukemia stem cells. So what Angela Kort-Reckart did in the lab was she took patient cells, selected the 34 positive cells, transplanted them into these mice intrahepatically at birth. They lack an immune system, so they allow high levels of engraftment. And then once leukemia was established, started treating them with vehicle, the JAK2 inhibitor that also inhibits FLT3, a really potent BCR-ABL inhibitor, or the combination. And because we're cognizant of the niche effects of these drugs and also that the leukemia stem cells are still niche responsive, we looked at the different hematopoietic niches to look at their response. By FACS, by nanoproteomics that Anil Sitarangani pioneered, and through the RNA sequencing, actually. So I'll just show you the nanoproteomics data from Anil. And basically what we found here was after treatment with this drug, again, the one that we have in clinical trials, we're repurposing it here for blast crisis leukemia stem cell eradication. You see a decrease in phospho-STAT5 after treatment. It's in green here. And a decrease in phospho-JAK2, again, after treatment. It's in green there. So that seemed good, at least in terms of decreasing leukemia stem cell survival, but we're most interested in the regenerative or cloning property of leukemia stem cells, and we really wanted to see if we could abrogate that property. And what Angela showed is that you decrease survival of these leukemia stem cells in the marrow after combination therapy, but most importantly, in our toughest niche, we're actually significantly reducing the serially transplantable leukemia stem cell burden after using the combination of this JAK2 FLT3 inhibitor and a BCR-ABL inhibitor. So we think that this is an important piece of preclinical data that will guide future combination clinical trials for people that find themselves in these tough circumstances where their disease is progressing to accelerated phase or blast crisis. Another thing that happens as patients accelerate is they upregulate BCL2 family members. And in humans, there are actually 6 BCL2 family members that we use to promote stem cell survival. And what we wanted to see is how many of those do the leukemia stem cells co-opt? What Daniel Goff did in the lab, together with Mark O'Mara and Kelly Frazier, as well as Karen Messer, was to see what distinguishes normal cord blood from chronic phase and blast crisis using a survival signature. And we could see that we could distinguish the 3 phenotypes. But perhaps most importantly, what this transcriptomic work showed was that there was splice isoform switching in the BCL2 family that promoted survival. So the long isoform of BCL2 family members was upregulated and the short isoform was lost. So the long isoform promotes survival. So we saw upregulation of BCL2 long, MCL1 long, BCLXL long, and BFL1 long as BCR-ABL was amplified. So what that means is that we would need to have a pan-BCL2 inhibitor to really knock down this exuberant capacity of the leukemia stem cells to survive. We could see upregulation of BCLXL when we transduce with BCR-ABL, increase BCL2 protein as we expand that myeloid progenitor population. So we started working with Maurizio Pilecki and John Reed at the Burnham, and they had a pan-BCL2 inhibitor. This is called Subuticlax, which is a compound we actually started working with about 3 years ago now. And the reason this is important, unlike other BCL2 inhibitors, it inhibits BCL2, BCLXL, MCL1, and BFL1, all of which we find are upregulated in the leukemia stem cell in blast crisis CML. And so what Daniel did was he looked to see what effects Subuticlax had in the spleen niche versus the marrow niche on leukemia stem cell survival and found a reduction in both niches with single-agent treatment with Subuticlax. And then you see a reduction in human BCL2 expression in the marrow of the treated animals. What this compound seems to do is it seems to sensitize the leukemia stem cell to BCR-ABL inhibitor therapy, particularly in the bone marrow, where, again, we've had trouble getting rid of these leukemia stem cells because they tend to become dormant, and perhaps most importantly, increase the survival of serial transplant recipients when you use sabutoclax in combination with a BCR-ABL inhibitor. So this is a subject of an early translational 2 grant through CIRM, and we're moving full speed ahead in terms of trying to develop this for potential clinical trials. And then for the final piece of leukemia stem cell biology, this is the view, I think, that these paragliders see. They know where they like to be. They really hug the niche, and they become dormant. They go to sleep in that niche, and that's how these cells can evade standard therapies. And so what we found, and this is with Kristen Smith in the lab, was that the leukemia stem cells, once transplanted into these mice, really like to go to the endosteal surface or the endosteal niche. Phosphohistone H3 marks dividing cells. The cells in the endosteal niche really are asleep. They do not want to proliferate. So we started to think, what links this dormancy to leukemia stem cell potential, and had a seed grant to be able to start looking into some of these mechanisms, and also a collaboration with Tanishta Rea, where she discovered in a mouse model of chronic myeloid leukemia that it seemed that sonic hedgehog pathway activation promoted leukemia stem cell self-renewal in those mice. What she used in her study was cyclopamine to inhibit the essential agonist of this pathway called smoothin. And what we know about cyclopamine is it's from corn lily. If sheep eat that corn lily, they have progeny with one eye. That's called cyclopia. So we know this is not a drug for people. This is not ready for prime time. And this is where Wendy Levin came in, who's been our champion in industry in terms of being able to guide the studies with the hedgehog inhibitor that's far more selective for smoothin, called PF0444-9913. I'll call it just 913 from now on. And really what we wanted to see when we embarked on those studies with this particular compound was, is the pathway really activated during progression from chronic phase to blast crisis? And can it distinguish chronic phase and normal samples from blast crisis samples? Because we don't always know who's going to progress. And actually, with the RNA sequencing study, again through the CIRM disease team, we found that we could completely distinguish cord blood from chronic phase from blast crisis samples based on their hedgehog gene expression profile. And that's shown here more pictorially with the blast crisis samples here, cord blood here, and chronic phase here. There was one exception, and that was this blast crisis patient number 5 who really behaved more like a chronic phase patient, both in counts and also in response to therapy. Now, we thought, how do we go forward in terms of devising a preclinical model to test the activity of a very selective hedgehog inhibitor? So we turned back to our leukemia stem cell model of blast crisis CML. We found that GLE2 was a very important harbinger of progression. That's an activator of the pathway. When we looked in the spleens of transplanted animals at what happened after treatment with this hedgehog inhibitor, we saw a reduction in GLE2 expression. And we could quantify this using the nanoproteomics device, where you see decreased GLE2, and it was significant. Again, that was Anil that did that. Now, the surprise really came when we started to look at how was this drug working. We knew GLE2 was going down. There had been some suggestions that GLEs affect cell cycle control in stem cells. And what we found here was that these leukemic cells that like to go to the marrow and have that GNP phenotype and become quiescent, or RNG0 in the marrow, really are coaxed or coerced to go from G0 to G1 after treatment with this very selective hedgehog inhibitor. Karen Messer found in the RNA sequencing study done on these treated animals and the progenitors derived from those animals that the most significant change in gene expression occurred in cell cycle regulatory genes. So it was the negative regulators of cell cycle progression that were suppressed by this hedgehog inhibitor. And you can see this big change in cell cycle isoforms before and after treatment. So here's vehicle and here's the hedgehog inhibitor. So we said, okay, now they should be awake. They should be able to respond to a BCR-ABL inhibitor. And indeed, that's what happened when we used this drug, the hedgehog inhibitor, in combination with a BCR-ABL inhibitor. The other thing that we noted was there was upregulation of negative regulators of the pathway, NAM, protein kinase A, FK binding protein 8, casein kinase 1 alpha, and casein kinase 1 delta, demonstrating that we'd reverted to a normal phenotype so that the cells that were surviving after combination treatment were essentially normal. So what that suggests is that if we're going to tackle these tough diseases, we're likely to need a multi-pronged strategy. But it's not one size fits all, as I'm reminded in clinic every Wednesday by very brave patients that shake me and say, wake up, I'm not the same as everybody else. And so I think we really need to get into what's called precision medicine, and I like to call it precision regenerative medicine. By eradicating leukemic stem cells that are doing harm to the normal tissues, we allow the normal stem cells to take over. And we need to understand for each patient what pathways they've actually amplified, and so we can come up with more patient-tailored therapy. And in the case of CML, we know as it transitions to blast crisis that not only do they amplify BCR-ABL, but they also activate JAK2, Sonic Hedgehog, and BCL2. So I'd like to thank the people in the lab that did this amazing work. I don't want to point out any one person in particular because this is really evidence of absolute teamwork. We have a very active clinical trials group, and Dennis Carson has been a fantastic mentor and has really shown the way for the kinds of preclinical studies that have translated to the clinic. And, of course, Ida DeChaite for continuing to get us to do the right thing. And CIRM for funding a lot of the preclinical work and continuing to stay by us as we do this. There are also patients that have invested in it. So